From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Groundsman. Out here in the middle, leaning on their rakes alongside me, are my two fellow cutters of the turf, Roger Mitchell and Giles Morgan. Rog, come in.
Hi, how are you, Grant? Everything's good here.
I am splendid. Thank you very much, sir. And across there, Mr. Morgan, Captain, how are you?
Grant, how are you? It's very nice to hear your voice. It's been a while, but it's nice to see you back on the square.
It's been a while. It has indeed. I have to say, as people that appreciate good turf, hopefully you both watched the Masters at the weekend.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it was magical. Magical.
Those boys know how to push a mower. I've got to tell you that.
No, I've got to say this, and I know we're all aching to say it, but I think I saw the greatest 5-6 holes of golf from Tiger Woods. That's the bit that I will never forget as long as I live. I have been a man who has... Well, actually, 10 off on a par 3 is a good score for me. But genuinely, what he did from 13 onwards, you could see that face when he came off 12 and the frustration, the irritation, and then something within him. Just what a great, great advertisement for everyone who plays the game of golf, which is, I will finish this round as well as I can. And what he then produced was from the highest shelf. Good on him.
It was something, and it was effortless, right? I mean, it was absolutely effortless.
Yeah, it was a privilege to watch, because it's all those things about never give up and all of those things he just espoused in that final hour and a half. And I thought, you know, he's a story that keeps on giving us a new story in the world of Tiger Woods. But that was very, very special.
Yeah, it was. It was.
Tell me,
I have to say.
Sorry, Grant. On you go.
Good.
No, I was just going to say, I was going to ask you both as more golf guys than me. Can you explain to me our own Rory McIlroy, what's his story in the first rounds and just kind of like then having to play catch up?
Well, he said, actually, it was interesting in his post round interview, and he was talking about DJ and saying how valuable it was, this ability that DJ has to just, you would never know if he's had a triple bogey or an eagle. You'd just never know. His demeanor is so constant, and it is. And he's got this ability to shrug off whatever's happened and just focus on the next hole, which, you know, Rory admits that he doesn't have. What I hadn't seen is in another interview, he said, Rog, that he has been known to lose a stone in weight around the Masters week because of all the stress he feels.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was really, really interesting, because, you know, here's a guy, as he showed in, you know, whatever 54 of the holes, what a supreme golfer he is. I mean, he really was just fabulous to watch. But it was almost, you know, like Tiger, until he was out of it and he could relax, the stress just was suffocating.
Well, I will say, though, against Rory, and it's something that he knows I'm still displeased about, we actually discussed it on the captain's table. About 3 years ago, he was due to play in a World Golf Championship event that HSBC sponsor. And he had room service the night before the tournament in China, and then played no part at all in the tournament. Suspecting, I think, maybe that he maybe have lost more than 12 or 14 pounds, but I suspect an awful lot more. But he did. He's all energy, Rory, and it was interesting hearing what he's saying. He's got this new focus, and it's calmed him down. I thought he looked in great nick.
Yeah,
my God,
he did. Yeah, yeah. I have to say, with the next Masters only 5 months away, it's going to be very interesting to see. You know, that's almost within the realm of momentum from this one. You know, I mean, DJ is presumably still going to be firing all cylinders. It'd be interesting to see if Rory can kind of just move from this one to that next one without, you know, a huge build up, without all the anticipation that goes with it. It'd be very interesting, because, you know, the next major is the Masters again.
And has he won the Masters? I can't remember.
No, he needs it for his Grand Slam.
Oh, he's got the other three.
Had a four-shot lead. He had a four-shot lead on the beginning of the final day, about, I don't know, 6 years ago, Giles, maybe 6-7 years ago.
Yep.
And shot 80 and just crumbled. And you know that four-shot lead had gone by the time he got on the third tee. And you know, he came back the next year and played really, really well. In fact, he came back the next major and won the US Open by 11 shots, I think it was, or 12 shots or something. So, you know, he has the ability, there's no doubt, and he has the ability to put the stuff out of his mind. But you just wonder whether if he can get that Masters and finish the career Grand Slam off, it frees him up to just go crazy.
I tend to think his time has come and gone, I must be honest. Not because, I just think that... The wind is no longer in his sails, and you know.
No, I disagree.
You honestly think he's going to come back with the competition that's around
young,
now?
He's too young and he's too good. He's too young and he's too good. I don't think there's any way he's finished.
I entirely agree with Grant. And you talk to any pro about the Rory McIlroy swing and the way he gets himself around the golf course. They're all in awe of him. He's the real deal. And yeah, he may not have had a major for 6-7 years, whatever it is, but he's not an old man. Plenty of people win majors much later on, as we've seen with Woods, etc. And he's very happy. He's got a wonderful family life now. He's got a lot of the things that happened in his 20s are past him. You know, he had management issues and various bits and pieces. Being a young man, obviously, he was engaged to Wozniacki before. He's had a young man's life. He's now maturing into a fine sort of not middle-aged man, whatever, 30s man with family. And he doesn't need to work again in terms of he's comfortable with money, family's sorted. I think he'll be in a
very good headspace. This is my point, Giles. I think he's a little bit like Enzo Ferrari used to say about drivers. You know, once they get married, they're no longer going to take that extra risk. The edge comes off a little bit. I think he's not that bothered anymore. I think.
I couldn't disagree.
I just look and
you only have to look at his Peloton scores to know this guy has got the eye of the tiger. I think, no pun intended. I think that I'm with Grant on this one, Rog. He's he may not, you know, winning a major is not easy. It's not like he's disappeared into the 30s or the 40s of the world rankings. He's there or there.
But this is my point. He's got the talent to do it. I just don't think he's got that desire anymore. I think being in the top six, the top 10, and then doing the little videos with Tiger and you know, the other lads around the chipping. I think he's happy with that now. I think he's done his thing.
Yeah. Next April, when he's putting on his green jacket and they ask him, you know, how did he get here? And he says, you know what?
I'd be happy with that. I'd like him to do it. But I think Portdown took a lot out of him psychologically. I think that'll be very difficult to come back from.
We'll agree to disagree until next April. Now, gentlemen, what do we have on the agenda for today? Roger, I know there's a couple of things that you're fairly animated about this week.
Well, you know, no, it's not really it's not really animated, and certainly I don't want to get on a soapbox because that's not...
What?
You don't want to get on another soapbox because you'd get vertigo.
Rog, can I do the inevitable bag? Is it not two soapboxes?
Yeah. Oh, for goodness sake. For goodness, shortest jokes. Now, if I was as prickly as some of the youngsters these days, I would be going berserk at these kind of things now, but I'm not. I'm absolutely super chill tonight. And I want to start, I'd like to start, as some of our listeners have asked us,
Is this Roger Mitchell is no longer prickly? What's going on? Am I on the right channel?
Well, like I said in the last episode, it's more moody these days. It's much more moody, and I'm feeling pretty mellow today.
Nice.
So I want to start to do what I think some of our listeners have asked, is that we link in the Groundsman some of the themes that come out in the Captain's Table, in Goal on Goal, and obviously more importantly in the big interview. And I'd like to go back to one of the stories we mentioned, which is Reynolds and mate buying Wrexham.
Yes.
Which we had a joke about, and of course will remain historic because I said that Wrexham was a port city, and a few people sent me a picture of Google Maps with its spine slap in the middle of fucking Wales. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not my thing, geography. As long as you can, well, certainly not in Wales. I don't think I've ever been to Wales, to be honest.
Well, you'd be welcome with open arms, particularly in Wrexham.
Yeah. Why am I talking about these two guys? Because it's now become clear why they have bought Wrexham Football Club. We speculated, Grant and I, and the reality is that they want to invest a lot of money and they want to make it part of a reality TV show. They want to cover the whole of the rebirth, if you will, of Wrexham and its progress on camera, fly on the wall. And here's the kicker, Giles. A historic football club, and it is a historic football club, will become nothing more than a piece of content.
Yep. And you've been talking about this a lot, and it's something that I struggle with, which is I understand the need for content and the need for entertainment and the need for sort of endless gratification of people's amusement by creating more and more creativity and great ideas. And yes, at some point, I suspect Wrexham will be jettisoned and a football club will maybe not be around forever. So I sit very firmly on both sides of the fence, where I understand the modernity of what sport really is in terms of finance, which is about engagement, entertainment, and commercializing that interest into a commercial model, which is called people and customers, versus something much more in the sort of Simon Barnes, Ed Smith philosophy of why sport has a real role in the kind of progress of being a human being. And I find myself torn all the time about it, because this kind of story, I can't bear reality TV anyway. Sort of, I understand it, but I don't necessarily embrace it.
Roger, just explain to me Wrexham. Without wishing to offend any Welsh people listening, what exactly can you do with Wrexham? I mean, there's content and there's content, but if that content is Wrexham, then your audience is fairly limited. I mean, I'd struggle to see how you take Wrexham to be any kind of global brand.
No, it's not going to be a global brand. It's going to be content. And this...
Yeah, but what content? Who wants to watch content about Wrexham except Wrexham fans?
Who wants to watch a whole lot of amateur cooks go through a tournament where they do certain tests and one of them gets eliminated every week? MasterChef.
Well, come on, but hang on a second. There are plenty of people who cook and who will watch that because it's cooks. If you're a football fan, you don't want to watch Wrexham because your options are watch the Premier League, watch
This is the thing, and forgive me if I'm kind of like preaching a little bit, but I think this is so fundamental we should take a little bit of time here. Let's take the example of MasterChef. MasterChef isn't about them cooking beef bourguignon and getting it judged. It's about how they then react to it, how they react to the judges' criticism of it, and then they do the Daily Show where you end up having a story arc where they've got an enemy that then the producers make into a kind of like rivalry that they then put words in their mouth and they end up being, you know, nasty to each other, and then they'll make mates and it'll go into two groups. The point I'm making is that it's just a vehicle for watching social interaction where you're creating what is basically wrestling. It's just wrestling. Wrestling's done this for decades. And now the rest of TV with MasterChef, X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, whatever you want to call it, even Strictly, they've understood that. And now it's coming to your local football club. It's the same in Como. Here in Como, it's the same thing. It's run It's owned by Asians who wanted to make Como the center of attracting a lot of young players from all over the world because it's a beautiful part of the world. And guess what? You're going to be on reality TV, so why don't you come and play for us? The fact about whether they go up, down or not is kind of irrelevant now.
You think? I mean, I just...
Yeah, I do think.
I get it, right? I get it. But let's look at the other options here, the other examples of this. When you look at Man City All or Nothing, global brand, reality TV, premiership glamour, big name players, it's got all that, right? I get why they want to watch it. You look at, you know, the All Blacks, you look at the Arizona Cardinals, you look at all the different sporting franchises they've done with this. Fantastic, right? Absolutely brilliant entertainment. But we already have either a connection to or a fascination with those subjects. Sunderland Till I Die, slightly different story. But Sunderland is a storied old English football team. And that was great drama. But I don't see that that has done anything enormous for Sunderland as a global brand. I mean, there are still, when I talk to people about All or Nothing Man City or the All Blacks, everyone seems to have watched it. Talk about Sunderland Till I Die, and it's a much smaller cohort that have watched it. What do you do with Wrexham, as reality TV? And again, I don't want to slag Wrexham off.
This is honestly the kernel of everything. When you're watching X Factor or MasterChef,
But this is the point.
Loads do, Grant. And the point is they do it because they recognize somebody like themselves. So it's not important about the vehicle, whether it's Sunderland or whether it's Wrexham.
And Rog, this is why it saddens me, is I absolutely understand what they're saying, what they're trying to do and what they will achieve. Because like your example of Great British Bake Off or MasterChef or X Factor is exactly what it is. It is a vehicle for entertainment that will be very entertaining to certain people. My sadness is it debases both a football club ultimately, in the short term it may not, but in the long term it possibly will. But also it debases maybe what traditional sport is. And there's the crux of the argument, and I know something you're very hot on, is we are in the middle of a revolution, we're in the middle of a consumption revolution. What sport means to people is maybe different from what sport meant 30 years ago, let alone 60 years ago. You have to put that in context of what did sport do 150 years ago? It was the entertainment and a diversion for the middle classes who had time on their hands. Life has changed, technology's changed, the world has changed, and therefore people's entertainment habits have ultimately changed, and this is the latest iteration. I feel a certain mourning for perhaps a passing of what I consider to be very important at a fundamental level, which is organized sport with clubs, etc., and all of that. But it is also the reality, no pun intended, with reality TV, of entertainment is now the driving nuance for what sport is all about. And in this case, it's not about tickets and watching Wrexham Football Club play football. It's about generating revenue through a new entertainment platform.
That's true. And, you know, what I would say, and again, I keep coming back to this thing about there's no longer a collective noun for sport. So we can't say sport. What we are talking about in this case here is a football club with an extremely niche and aging and declining audience who, right, in any kind of future of unbundling and direct to consumer, is not going to do well. So you're talking about, Leighton James will be turning in his grave. Brian Flynn won't like this. What I'm saying, which sounds perhaps disrespectful of history and heritage, is that doesn't pay the bills. You know, so Wrexham Football Club and the people that follow Wrexham Football Club have got a choice. Do you want to stay totally irrelevant now? And I don't even think they're in the English Football League. I think they're in the one below. or would you like to have a Hollywood superstar with X zillion social media followers to be thinking about you, and you become a little bit of a host for an entertainment brand, but what's your choice? You know, is that or bust?
But Rog, do you? This is the bit I don't
tell
get.
Tell me.
I mean, look, think about it, right? For every MasterChef and every Great British Bake Off, there are 5, 6, 7, 8 cooking shows that you and I have never heard of, right? It's not, you can't just throw a thing there, a show on about cooking, and it become a big hit. It just doesn't work that way. And so with football, the reason it's tough is because MasterChef is a juggernaut and because the Great British Bake Off is a juggernaut in the UK. So the content coming out of other clubs is a much bigger juggernaut for Wrexham, just because you've got Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney.
But that is the point, Grant. We've talked about this before. We are taking sport to where the audience already exists. In this case, his social media popularity. In the case of KSI and Logan, it was their audiences, and it was the biggest boxing event of last year. This is exactly the point, Grant. If it wasn't Ryan, if the three of us decided to buy Wrexham, it ain't going anywhere. But the fact that it immediately hooks in to an audience that will follow anything that Ryan Reynolds does gives it one hell of a chance.
Roger, does what? Ryan Reynolds' Twitter followers all follow Wrexham.
This is the bit I think you're missing, Grant. Not for the results. They want to see, like, you know, those videos that still go around where you see the old school manager, you know, shouting in the dressing room. And it's a game that nobody cared about, you know, whether it was, you know, I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
You know those ones that still go around.
Yeah.
You will get that every week. You will get examples of a player that has been excluded the next week, and he'll have a little video to the camera saying, I don't understand it, it's not fair. This person's getting a game because, you know, he's gone out with the daughter of the manager. You can see the narratives, Grant. It's nothing to do with the result.
No, Roger, I can see that. It's the Truman Show. I can see that. I just don't know. In the Truman Show, which was a fantastic movie, everybody watched the Truman Show. I'm telling you right now, everybody is not watching Wrexham. I don't care what they do, because there's way too much competing content from franchises much bigger with much more star power than Wrexham. I just don't see how having these two guys gives them enough of a leg up to make them relevant.
Again, and this sounds awful, but it is the reality. They say they're going to invest, what, $3 million into Wrexham? Yeah?
Okay.
How much do you sell it to Amazon for, the series?
Okay, maybe.
Just follow the money. It's a genius idea.
But what's your longevity? Yeah, you put $3 million in, you sell it to Amazon for $5 million, and then in 3 years' time, you quietly exit stage left, maybe. But I don't think Ryan Reynolds thinks he wants to make $2 million out of this somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm perfectly willing to be totally wrong. I just don't see the attraction of Wrexham, even with two Hollywood owners. I don't see how it becomes compelling. But I hope I'm wrong, because I love the Sunderland till I die thing. But there's a history with Sunderland that attracted me to it in the first place.
Grant, do you like wrestling? Have you ever been interested in wrestling?
When I was about 7 and used to watch Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks from the assembly halls in Tunbridge.
Now we're talking.
On a Saturday afternoon with, was it Kent Walton? I've never had any interest in wrestling.
Well, but see, so you're not the audience. Why do you think wrestling is one of the biggest sports in America and globally? Because it's not a sport, is it? They just create a narrative that I've been sleeping with the other guy's wife and we're going to meet in the ring and I'm going to throw down a challenge.
No, Roger, that's fine, but you've got two wrestlers and they're both in on it.
Yeah.
Okay. If you've got Wrexham, who are they in on it with? How do you create the narrative when you've got one narrative?
The narrative is internal. It's kind of like internal. It's like MasterChef. You know,
Colour me unconvinced, Roger, I have to say.
I just don't think, and I don't think it's just you. I think a lot of the sports industry is missing this. I think they underestimate the difference in the way the content industry, the entertainment industries have evolved. and they're still talking about the soul and the tradition. And yeah, that will be fine for the big stuff. You know, the Masters we've talked about, for the Premiership, for the World Cup, for Formula One. But once you get down a little bit, it's going to be create narrative, create celebrities that Joe Bloggs can identify with and say, that could be me. And you build story arcs and you build kind of like tension. That's how content works.
Yeah, look I'm the first to admit your nose is far better at sniffing this
but
stuff.
But what do you think, Giles? I mean, am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, and that's why I sort of find myself uncommonly sort of sitting on the fence. My feet are firmly in both camps, which is I understand what's going on. I see this as an entertainment platform that could work very well if they get the production values right, if they get the right people behind it and they do it properly, it could become a fantastically interesting kind of virtual reality, whatever type of show type of thing it is. There's the other side of me which goes, what a shame, it's another football club that's on a bound, it's got to take the money. But there's something sort of special about the heritage of clubs and all the rest of it. That said, you know, I'm sure there was much wailing and gnashing of teeth when the Colosseum shut down, when the Romans all buggered off. So, you know, these things have to move on. And we are in a process, as Roger, you talk about a lot, and it's true when a sport is changing and the consumption of sport is changing as society change. And we are in a rapid societal change right now because of technology, because of probably COVID, because of all sorts of things. We are living in a part of human history where never has advancement in technology shifted society so rapidly. And therefore sport, which is always only ever a reflection on society because it serves society, it's changing again. And what the 10 and 15 and 20 year olds are doing is not the same as what we did 50 years ago because life and things are moving.
I think, you know, if you look, coming back to Grant's point about where's the context, where's the meaning, if you look at the success of TikTok, which is completely anonymous people, and there's a lot of them, Grant, so your point about volume is there in TikTok, and they see things on there and they start sharing them and they become important pieces of content for their generation.
But Roger, for a moment, I don't think, I mean, look, I see all this stuff come through, right? All these TikTok things. I've seen hundreds of them and I've laughed at lots of them. I've never once then decided, oh, I'm going to follow this person. You're so bombarded with this stuff all the time that who really goes any deeper than, oh, that's funny, that's interesting, maybe I'll share that with someone. But am I now going to follow, you know, I don't know, Wonky Dancer 5 on TikTok? No, I'm not. I don't care.
But Grant, you're focusing on the content creator there. The victory has been the platforms, has been TikTok's victory. So what I'm saying is, take the example of Wrexham again. Wrexham is the equivalent of Wonky Dancer 5, where the Ryan Reynolds...
I'm sure that's another platform, but there we go.
Where Ryan Reynolds is the winner. And I just don't think traditional sport that is based on, you know, a summer schedule that we all know about that starts from the Masters, that goes to the Monte Carlo tennis, that goes to Queens, that goes to the Open, that goes to the World Cup and the Euros and the Olympics. I think that has blinded us from what is the rival content entertainment industry of the younger people, which has got nothing to do with that routine and that schedule. And I think we are heading for a fall because we believe that meaning and soul is important and we love our nostalgia. And I just think one day, let me ask you this, Grant, what are the entertainment brands that are not transient? Because that's always correctly your point. Oh, it's also transient. These days, what are the brands in the entertainment world that you would say are, you know, multi-year, long-lasting? you've got the Disney franchises or franchises in general.
You're looking at movie studios. You're looking
You're looking at big, big global brands. They can be called Avenger. They can be called Star Wars. Whatever they are, those are the ones that can keep going year after year. Their equivalent in football is called Man United, Barcelona, and Juventus. They're the ones that will keep hold. Even them, it depends a little bit on what players and how they move. But even they've got a brand that can probably think about a multi-year strategy.
Yeah, but that's my point, Rog. Where does Wrexham fit into that?
Nowhere.
Wrexham is the indie movie, right?
They're just a vehicle grant.
$3 million at the box office and covers its costs.
Well, there you go. That's exactly it. It worked. You know, he probably says, I'm going to make money on this. Oh, I get to own a football club. I can play Football Manager for real. I've got some link to Wales that nobody really understands, but who cares? And my PR people will spin this as I'm investing in European soccer. Where's the downside for Ryan Reynolds? Nowhere. Wrexham's just a vehicle.
We'll see. I just have this feeling that this is not going to play out the way he and his advisors and everybody else thinks. I think this is going to be a big fat nothing. The first time he shows up at Wrexham, we'll see a few pictures on the news, and we'll see at Sky Sports or Sports Centre or whatever. We'll show him in the crowd, and it'll be forgotten a week later.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. But you know, I think when you link it to a couple of the other things that have come out in the last few shows of ours over the last couple of months, you know, you saw the ESPN layoffs this week.
Yeah.
And it's not just ESPN. It's all of traditional media. Their model isn't working. Cut the cord. What they've put out as content for years isn't making money anymore. You know, you see, and you know, we discussed that with Al Guido. I said in a few years, less than 50% will be cabled homes. He said it'll maybe not be that quick. I tend to think it will be. With Jerry Cardinale, we challenged him on his regional sports network. Yes, I think it's called the Yankees one. Nobody wants them anymore. They've been dropped by everywhere. The Sinclair Group, which is the biggest collection of them, they can't get a gig anymore. You know, everything that was the bread and butter of folks like us consuming sport is all up in the air. And I still marvel at people talking about, yeah, but you lose the soul and the meaning. This is just a business. It's the entertainment business now. And the sooner sport gets its head around this and tries to maintain the soul as much as it can once it's sorted out that it's got a business model that doesn't lose money, then the better will be. But let's start by realizing it's competing with Fortnite, it's competing with TikTok, and it's competing with everything else they do on those bloody phones of those.
Well, look, the irony is not lost on me, given my position on this Wrexham thing, that we've just spent half an hour talking about it. So
there you go.
So perhaps we should shift gears a little bit. Giles, what's got your overalls in a bunch this week?
Well, yeah, my rake's broken. That's been my biggest irritation. But other than that, well, I'm slightly, I still want to carry on this topic a little bit that Roger's on a little bit, which is about where the true value of what the sports industry holds, because I still believe it's very, very, very valuable and largely untapped. There's a lot more value, a lot more oil in the ground to be taken out, which is people are passionate about sport in whatever iteration that may be. The iteration may be about traditional watching football or rugby or cricket or NFL or whatever it may be. Or it may be about new sport or sport reimagined, which is a younger generation in highlights. But the point is, everybody who touches sport in any way, whether it's live or highlights or as a fan or buys merchandise or goes to a stadium when you're allowed to go to a stadium again, whether it's buying presents for your grandchildren, is this whole sense of being a fan of sport provides an industry with the most valuable commodity, which is the data about people and it's being left still woefully underused, which means that this creaking TV model, which Roger alludes to, is causing great panic and distress because finance is now not as readily available because of media numbers. And yet we've seen over COVID, I think 100% proven now, which is why maybe private equity is coming in, is that sport is weatherproof. People love it. And when it's switched off, they want it back. And therefore, this is an industry that has to absolutely gird its loins, be brave, embrace the future, and understand that consumer behavior is the golden ticket to a future of sport, possibly that has never been seen before. So it's not even my rake getting into a sort of flap or anything like that. I remain such a bull on sport. And even in these shit times where we're all locked down and sort of even the dog gets a bollocking now, and he's only 4 months old, is that this industry has got so much value to come.
Yeah, I mean, Giles, I heard you on that really good podcast with Richard Gillis, Sports Pro. And there was I thought Gillis was really good in that, actually. Although there was one thing that I think is right at the heart of certainly the big sponsor agency ecosystem in London and in America, which is this, creative over data argument. And I heard on that conversation, Richard was saying, yeah, but, you know, for the big, big events, the really, really big ones, doing the data route is quite small beer. It's quite cheap. It's quite sales promotion-y. And, you know, surely those events require the big creative moments of awareness and exposure and brand association. I guess that could be true, but I think the point that is missed is that if you don't do the data bit, you can't segment the industry of sport, which is no longer a collective noun. You can't segment them properly, which means you can't do proper strategic marketing. Because when I've segmented from the youngsters we've talked about to the people like Grant, female viewers, to whatever, only then can I start putting together a strategic marketing plan. So I don't think there's any option now other than a serious investment in understanding fan behaviours, the segment of fan behaviours. And, you know, I think probably my view on this changed about 5 years ago, where I saw Adam Silver at the NBA saying, you know why we do our, what's it called, League Pass? I can't remember what they are.
League Pass.
Yeah. Why we do that? It's not because of the money. It's because when we've got the direct relationship with those viewers, we can tell what turns them off. And he's on record as saying, because we knew that, we had to change the system of the timeouts. We had to change their length. We thought about selling the fourth quarter separately. So he basically said the League Pass was not about money. They had plenty of money. It was about them starting to understand the behavior of their fans, the segmented fan base, and tailor their offering and content and distribution platform accordingly. And that's what I think was missed in that conversation you had, Giles. It's not about small or grandiose or cheap or super rich. It's about, do you have any choice now? You absolutely, Adam Silver said, need to understand what is working in your product and what doesn't. And the only way to do that is an investment in data.
Well, Roger, what Al Guido said, and I think he was absolutely right, and Jerry Cardinale said it as well, which is, There's an art and a science to any kind of business. That the science is, and this is where sport has been given the information, that it has been craving, but it didn't know it was craving, which is rather than dancing in the dark, to quote Bruce Springsteen, the lights have been switched on. They now know, they have the ability to know everything about all of the segments of all our audiences, of all the fans all over the world. Not, hopefully, where they just hope that the numbers might, there might be some TV numbers that provide a sort of guide, but empirically, they can prove dynamically who the fan is and actually, as you said, what when they're switching on, what they're watching, what they like, what they don't like. This is the golden ticket for the sports industry, which is
the only ticket.
Now that you know everything you need to do, you can now think about your marketing and then go creative. Start to use the artistry of the great marketers, because data on its own doesn't give you the end result.
That's right.
But it gives you the code to then go ahead and create and create magic. And that's why the sports industry is sitting, I still think, sitting on this pot of gold it doesn't realize, which is for years and years and years, there was no way of finding out who the fan was unless they turned up at a stadium, because they didn't exist. And
even then,
and they didn't do it. But it was possible technically. Now it is possible, but it isn't just possible by doing the odd sort of qualitative bit of data market research. This is real-time data, and it gives all of the information. And the reason we're seeing private equity, we're seeing big finance coming into sport, is that they understand, in the way that many blazer wearing people in the sports industry are only just waking up to, is they know that the value lies
That's
in the
right,
behavior
Charles.
Of the consumer. And the moment that that is absolutely grasped by brands, investors, and most importantly, the rights holders, there is going to be a complete change to how sport is marketed and, most importantly, how it's invested. And I've said this many times before. I wish I'd been paying attention in my former job, and I wish that I had then what I know now is possible of how to make big investment decisions in sport. Because if I were sitting as a brand now, looking at how to engage certain consumer bases, I'd be going straight to music and sport and putting all my money into there.
And where would you, Grant, if you, let's say, won the lottery from where you're coming from now, and you thought, well, what do I want to do in sport? Where would you spend that money now, Grant?
If I had to spend it in sport?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great question, Roger. I don't know which lottery I'm winning here, what kind of money.
Well, let's say you've got a billion.
Well, look, I mean, if I just want a franchise that I think I'm going to make money on, that's going to grow, I'm probably ignoring football. I'm ignoring the Premier League, because I think the pay structure there is going to cripple that business at some point. But I'm thinking that NBA franchises, I think, are, although expensive, I think the scope they have for expansion around the world is still big, and there is a never ending treadmill of enormously talented youngsters coming through who all resonate with audiences. I think that's where my money would probably go. I still think lockdown has proven to me, certainly, that golf is more resilient than people thought. I think there's money to be made in the golf business. I think golf is the one sport that I won't say it hasn't been impacted by the lack of fans, but the lack of fans has mattered the least to the watcher on TV. I think the sport as content model, Rog, which you've talked about, I totally get it, but I don't think it's going to be as easy as that. I think you need an existing story. You need an existing narrative. You need a storied club that's fallen on hard times, for example, that you can rescue. And I'm sorry, but Wrexham just ain't it. You need a club that has a tradition and a history that you can allow people to tap into. So it's not just about content, it's about a story arc that brings you full circle and you have that redemption. There's a lot of places. I think you could put money in all kinds of places in sport. Rugby is another one that I think, with the right money coming in, has a tremendous future.
Well, That's interesting, because I'll refer to another thing that happened in over the weekend, where I'm going to go back to this. I know you two hate this, and I know a lot of people of our generation hate it, but I've been saying this for a long time. The combination of an audience of content with gamification, fantasy, and betting is going to be the cornerstone of sport going forward. And I'm referring to my favorite friends at Barstool, their golfing guru called Riggs, who has got him and his bro mates in a room, and they're betting shot by shot. Is he going to hit the fairway? No, he put it in the trees. It's high fives all around. It's me and my son watching the Premiership, not having any interest in any of the teams.
How long are you going to watch that for, Rog? Well, how long are you going to watch that?
I think it's gamification. I have to give you the example of the fantasy football. I have got no interest in English Premiership. I'd have no feeling for any team, but I've got a fantasy team that is doing well. It allows me a moment of bonding with my son. Who are we going to change? Why do we change? Is Grealish going to do it? What about after the England break? You know, Salah's now got an injury. The Liverpool defences. So what I'm saying is the sport is creating interest from casual fans in that segmentation. I would be a casual fan because in this case it's fantasy. If I was a bettor, and that's how DraftKings has become now a bookmaker, from fantasy to betting, I'd be all over that. And so what I'm saying is I think that lasts big time, Grant, because that gives you your water cooler moment, your bonding moment, and if you're playing for money, it gives you a little bit of a thrill that hurts you or gives you a bit of a boost in the weekend. Again, that's a theme that I think is desperately underestimated, and everybody says, I hate the bro culture, I hate how transient and off the cuff and disrespectful they are. But that's the way it's going. That's what I think.
Well, isn't it more that there's just a lot of options for a lot of people's taste? And I personally find the Barstool stuff fairly unfunny, and I'm not really into the bro culture thing. But that doesn't mean that that's the only way for me to watch golf or anything else, any other sport. And therefore, again, what technology provides is so many different channels for people to watch and get involved with the way they want to do it. I think the gamification thing is quite interesting, and things are changing. I don't mind being old school. I'm with Keith Pelly. I don't mind being an old git. And you know, I'll be an old git for many years to come, and my money will be good for that model too. So I don't think we should decry. It's not all about the youth.
No, it's segmentation, sure.
Exactly, and it's perfectly all right to take 50-year-olds' money away from them and enjoy the sport the way they want to do it. So I think what's interesting to me is that and I think what you say about the collective noun is absolutely right, Rog, is that in the old days, one watched sport and it was the boat race in the UK because that's all there bloody well was to watch. So everyone was united by it because there was no other way of watching any other channel. There were only three at the time or whatever it was. Now there are a million channels, a million forms of entertainment. Creative people allow all sorts of channels to evolve, and therefore sports have to be creative. It's perfectly all right, I think, for a sport to remain entirely traditional and just keep doing what it's doing. It may not grow its audience, but that's okay because there will be a market and an audience for it. What's extraordinary to view is just how it's changing so fast.
Yeah, look, Rog, you and I have gone back and forth on this a lot. You know my views on the whole bro culture thing. I think it's a moment in time. I think it's a moment in time that is already on the wane. I don't think it has any longevity at all. And seeing that, I saw those clips of all those guys betting on shot by
shot. In the trees.
Yeah, I see it. And you know, you kind of, what's going on here? Okay. Look, I remember people were betting when I was working in the city in the late 80s and early 90s in London. People were betting with City Index on, you know, spread betting on every football game that was on. Right, the beginning of the Premier League in 92, we were betting. I mean, I remember they used to make a market for the time from the kickoff, the time until the ball first went out of play.
Yep.
And you could go long or short that. You could either, you know, if you thought it was going to go, it was going to keep in play for a long time, you'd go long. If you thought it was going to boot it straight into touch, you go short. And people would bet on that. They bet on the number of yellow cards. They bet on everything, right? They would absolutely bet on everything. And it was fine. And there were people that would do it religiously on every game. Of course, some footballers heard about it and would kick off and pass the ball around for like a minute and a half in the Premier League games because they'd all had bets on how long until the first dead ball. But that was 30 odd years ago, Rog. That hasn't changed. It's broadened out a little bit, but it's these things are not. They're not going to take over the world. This idea that gambling is going to take over the world, I just think is wrong. I don't think it's going to take over the game. It's going to subsume everything in front of it. The people that like to bet, I promise you, they're already finding a way to bet.
Oh, sure.
The companies that make money out of the gambling will do very well if they can broaden out and create an ease of access to a gambling platform. They'll make a lot of money. But I don't see that necessarily changes sport.
Here's why I think it changes it. Younger generations don't have our patience. The famous, they don't watch the 90 minutes anymore. The Open is too slow. Forget test match cricket. Do you know what keeps them watching it? In-play betting. That's it. That's why it is absolutely crucial. And
yeah, but Roger, okay, but look, but how long does that
forever,
keep them watching it?
Forever.
You think they're going to want to bet on every single game, every single day?
No, it keeps them engaged because otherwise they would switch off. It's a double hit for them. You know, they've got a good interest in football or the sport, but it's not compelling enough. It's not snappy enough. There's too many down periods, and that's where betting comes in. It keeps them engaged.
But Roger, look, yeah, I get that, but only if you have a proclivity towards wanting to bet on everything.
Or fantasy.
Not everybody has that.
Or gamification.
No,
I think they do.
But not everybody has that.
I think they do.
They don't. They just don't. Not everybody wants to sit there and bet on every single kick of a football game. They just don't. I mean, I get it. There are people that absolutely do, and that is the lifeblood. But I think that is a much smaller demographic than perhaps people think.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. I'll tell you why, because that whole sector, we mentioned it, the last groundsman or the one before, what I call the sports data guys, and those are Genius Sports, who, oh, by the way, have now been listed via one of the famous SPACs. Mm-hmm. You've got Sport Radar, who is very well financed by big money. You've got stats, and you know they're saying that they're going to control the world. You've got IMG Arena, you've got Atrium that's financed by PE money. The big finance isn't all over this sector. If they think like you do, Grant, I think they see it the way I do, and that's why they are putting huge money into consolidation, eat or be eaten. Because sport data, in this case used for betting, not the way we were talking about for marketing earlier, for use, yeah, is just the oil. It's everything. And
Well, look, this story is definitely not going away, Roger. You're absolutely right. This is going to play out over many, many years.
Last question for my fellow groundsman before we get back to work. You guys are friends of... this is an imaginary scenario. Don't think you are friends of Greg Clark, but you watch him in that committee room and he comes out and he calls you or texts you, say, how did I do? What should I do now? What is your advice, the two of you, to that man?
Charles, you can go first.
What?
He'd definitely call you before me.
Well, what should he do right now?
No, if he'd come to you for an advice as a friend after that performance, what would you have said to him as his friend?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, you play it back and you realise that every heffalump trap that was available, he managed to walk into, which slightly sort of horse bolted door open kind of thing. It happened. So I'm not sure there's much you can say other than we live in a world where on one level, we have absolutely to get it right because society quite rightly has changed, and that is good. On the other level, there are, I think, as young Lawrence Fox talks about, there are language fascists who are looking at every opportunity to damn those who say anything that may utter in the wrong order, tonality, or whatever. And somewhere in the middle lies common sense. I don't think that Mr. Clark had quite thought it through. I don't think he'd been quite well briefed. And I suspect also the occasion, I know a couple of people who've been through those parliamentary select committees, and apparently they are truly grueling and awful and terrifying and all the rest of it. So I think what I'd say to him is probably go home and have a drink, because it's going to be a shit couple of days. And it was for him. And I, on one level, I feel for him. I really do, because, you know, he certainly didn't mean to cause offence. At the same time, I think there was a lot of offence was taken that could have been well avoided.
Grant?
Well, Charles, I think your point there is the crux of this whole thing. He didn't mean to cause offence, but offence was taken. And that's my problem with this, is that the people who choose to take offence at stuff, it's automatically then assumed that offence was meant. And there's a huge difference between the two. I felt very sorry for him, you know, because his character gets dragged through the mud, you know, by the media in the days that followed it. And here's a guy who you could see was clearly stepping on eggshells, and he was trying to choose his words carefully. He was trying to choose the right words. And, you know, it must be exhausting trying to do that. And sadly, we live in a world where if you say the wrong word, or you choose the wrong descriptor, and some of the descriptors he's used, let's be honest, were absolutely the descriptors you were supposed to use a short while ago. I mean, even the descriptors change and mature and evolve with age. So I felt incredibly sorry for him, and I have a huge problem with this culture that you talked about Giles, you know, people, the language fascists who are just looking for any possible slip up, anybody who accidentally says the wrong thing or says something which gives them reason and cause to take offence. I have a huge problem with it. And I think a lot of people are dealt with incredibly unfairly because of that. And you know, when did it become impossible to just make an honest mistake and choose the wrong words, for God's sake? I mean, I felt very sorry for him, Roger, I have to say.
Well, this may surprise you, but I think I'm going to take the other side of that trade. Not because I disagree with words and causing offence and meaning it. I think I'm going to take the point of view of branding and perception now. If he called me, I would have said something like this. I said, look, mate, you might write this out. You may not. You might. But I'd ask you, Greg, to ask yourself, do you present the right image for association football in 2020? If you think you do, hang on. If you think that image that you gave is rather tired and gives a smell of overripe, I would suggest that you get out of there as quick as possible. And of course, the answer is yes. It looked awful. You know, it would give nobody any confidence that the FA, the governing body of football in England, was fit for purpose to lead into the kind of dialogues and conundrums or conundra that we talked about all through this episode. He struck me as somebody that wouldn't know what we were talking about. And the fact that he got some of those traps wrong is just convincing me that's the case. So I think, sadly, it's been caught up in the language fascism argument, whereas the fact is it was patently obvious to anybody that English football needs somebody very, very significant.
Right, so no, look, that may be the case, but hang on a second here. There are two ways to do that. One is you have a meeting behind closed doors and you talk about the fact that we need to change and we need someone who can be the right face and the right voice to lead us into the new era. And you put that person in and Greg steps down and everyone thanks him for his service. He's done a great job. Or two, you react and you get, you basically allow a witch hunt to take this guy down and you throw him under the bus in 2 seconds flat, let's face it. And I just think that's wrong. I think I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think we're no fans of the FA on here. We think that that organization has not been fit for purpose for some time. But the change should come as a choice because you realize that you're not fit for purpose. And there's plenty of people that have been telling them that for a long, long time. So
that's why I don't feel sorry for him, Grant. That's why I don't feel sorry for him. He was told about this, but he still likes the Royal Box. He still likes the jollies. He loves to sit as FIFA.
Roger, that might be the case.
No, I've seen so many of these guys that love it. They love the Blazerati thing. And, you know, whenever the shit hits the fan, they find a way to get through it, whether that's Blatter or Infantino or a zillion heads of FAs all through the world. I must admit, I felt like you wanted the bike, now pedal, because now you know, and he didn't have the balls for it, you know, and rightly so. You know, you're in the wrong movie, mate. You should never have been there. You made a couple of mistakes before. You should have had the common sense to get out before, and you put yourself in that situation, and too bad. That's so callous, isn't it? I've just heard that.
Well, I mean, for me, it's interesting. It's interesting, this one as well, because the trouble is we seek such perfection from everybody who is a leader that it soon, and I do take that point, Rog, but my God, we're so censorious about everything, particularly when it is the kind of howling media and the howling sense of social media maybe making the decisions that need to be done thoughtfully and progressively. And I'm not talking about Mr. Clark specifically. I'm just talking in general that these pogroms that happen via media that gets people ousted, that we seek such perfection, we actually find nobody. And that's a problem for me.
That's true.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. Well, gents, look, our lunch hour's up. We need to get back to it, sadly. But as always, a splendid break filled with interesting conversations that I will no doubt be thinking about in the days and weeks to come. So thank you as always for your company.
Thank you, lads. It was a great way to spend the lunch break, and thanks for putting up with me.
Cheers, fellas.
Well, all that remains is to thank you for listening to The Groundsman, to remind you to please take a moment, if you wouldn't mind, to rate and review the podcast, to share it with your friends. It really, really does help us grow the audience. Follow us on Twitter. If you're not already, you'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word, A-R-E. You'll find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71 on Twitter.
And you'll find me at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, until next time.